When our best fur friends leave our world, many of us are left wanting one last scritch, one last hug, one last walk together. One Last Network is a space for pet guardians to honor their pets in their senior years and to cope with the days leading up to and after their passing. Here's your host, Angela Schneider, founder of One Last Network and Big White Dog Photography in Spokane, Washington.
I'm a word nerd. I took linguistics courses toward my bachelor's degree, and I've been a professional writer for more than 30 years. Words matter to me. And recently, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about the language and words we use around death, loss, and grief, particularly when we're talking about our companion animals. So, I brought back my fellow word nerd and friend of the pod, Beth Bigler, for her third appearance. Beth, who has become so well known for her Instagram account, at Honoring Our Animals, is a certified pet loss grief counselor and pet chaplain. She holds bachelor's and master's degrees in arts and has over 20 years of experience in film, including in writing. She's even an instructor at New York Film Academy in their screenwriting and producing departments. Beth also uses writing in her counseling, helping her grief clients navigate their journey of love and loss with their pets through the power of story. Have a listen. Hey, my fellow word nerd, how are things for you today?
I'm peachy keen, word nerd.
Welcome back for the third time, Beth Bigler.
Hey, trifecta. Let's go.
Oh my God. Am I going to need to get you a jacket like Saturday Night Live five timer kind of thing?
Maybe for my fifth time, I could get some like cool swag. I'm here for it. I'm ready.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will do that. One of the reasons I brought you back today is because I'm stuck on this idea of the language around death, loss, and grief, and euthanasia. And if I may share with you an incident I had recently, I was sitting at a table and this woman kept talking about putting her dog down, putting her dog down, putting her dog down. And I grew up with that language. But for whatever reason, since I've been embedded in this world of pet loss grief for the last several years, it felt icky. Why?
You tell me.
Good question. I think it's because we don't learn about death and dying. And so we have this really awkward approach to it when it does happen. And it, of course, carries with it negative undertones. Of course, we're losing someone or some pet, right? Is there then a way to make it a more positive experience? Can it be a more positive experience by shifting the language?
Well, we know the way we talk to ourselves, the way we talk to others, the way we use words to express can have powerful impact on how we experience and feel and move through things. Like, there's research all over that, right? Like, the way we talk, the way we think, the way we lay down patterns in our brains is super important. So I guess the short answer, yes. But I think the challenge here for people is, how do we begin to reframe our language around something where, frankly, we have nothing? We have no other models. And why is that? Well, we live in a grief-avoidant, death-avoidant culture where not only do we not know anything really about grieving and mourning and death and how do we move through grief, but we also don't know how to talk about it. And in fact, we don't know how to talk about it with ourselves. We don't know how to talk about it with other people, which is why we have so many awkward conversations, or worse, no conversations at all. So I think, you know, when it comes to like, how do we improve this for people? We kind of got to figure out like where to begin. And one thing that can be very supportive is to get into dialogue with ourselves. And frankly, right now, before, like, even if you're not in the middle of a loss, even if you're not actively grieving, or if you are, sit down with yourself and make a list of every single thing that you remember ever being taught or told or modeled about death and loss and grieving. This is something I do with my pet loss grief counseling clients all the time. Write down every single message you ever received, every single language usage you ever heard. Who taught you that? And how do we feel about it now? Like, if we could rewrite some of those messages that we were told, what might they say? Because you might write down, well, you know, we put our dog to sleep, or we let him go, or we put him down. And we might look at that and say to ourselves, it might feel better to me to say, I helped him complete his life. I helped him transition, or I euthanized him, right? So we can start this dialogue with ourselves, but first we got to know what's floating around in there, what has stuck from our past.
Well, I know that we're separated by 10 years, but we both identify as Gen X. Me very much so. I'm Gen X through and through. We did grow up in a time where pets, especially dogs and cats, I think, were more disposable, shall we say. And today they are viewed more as family members by many people. Does the language then of euthanasia, specifically putting your dog down and putting a dog to sleep, or taking the dog to the farm, as we were told at one point, is that an anachronism of the ways we've viewed pets in the past compared to how we are now?
Yeah, I think when we hear people say those words, I associate those words as kind of old fashioned, right? I mean, that's something my dad might say, or my grandpa might say, you know, like, I don't know, put him down. Yeah, that's nothing any of my contemporaries would say. So I suppose in a certain way, that might be, you know, old school. But I also think a lot of my contemporaries and a lot of the people I work with don't have better language, and they haven't thought about what they'd rather say. So I hear that repeated, you know, because we don't have other options. Now, the word euthanize is fascinating, right? Because many people don't like it. They hate this word. People don't want to use it. You know, guardians I work with are like, I don't like the word, which is fascinating, right? Because if we know anything about where the word euthanasia comes from, it comes from the Greek words "you," meaning good, and thanatos, right, which means death. So the meaning of the word euthanasia means a good death. And that's a beautiful thing, right? In theory, right? Not every euthanasia is peaceful, not every euthanasia goes well, but just in terms of the language. But very fascinating to me that has such a negative connotation still for people when, you know, the root words, what the word actually means, it means a good death. So I'm fascinated that people hate that so much.
And ultimately, we're also trying to change the view around euthanasia as it not being a last desperate act, but a compassionate, loving act, right?
Well, certainly.
Again, words.
Well, every circumstance is different too, right? But in a world where we can plan a euthanasia or choose a euthanasia as a way to end suffering and to give a, you know, peaceful, non-chaotic death to our beloved, certainly it's not something to, you know, like, it's not a word to detest, in my view. But many people don't like it. I think for some people it feels very medical. Right? Because the only time we hear the word euthanize or euthanasia is in sort of, you know, a medical setting. But oftentimes I ask people, people come to me all the time I'm working with, I don't know what to say. I don't want to say I put him to sleep, or I laid him to rest, or, you know, and so what do I say? And I was like, well, what about euthanize? And very often they're like, no, not doing it. Don't like it. So it's not popular, but it may be accurate. Yeah.
Do you think the words around euthanasia, putting your dog down, do you think it impacts the decision-making process a bit? Like, I don't want to think about it. I don't want to plan it. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to do it, because it all just sounds negative.
Well, a recurring theme, you know, for many people in an anticipatory grief moment is, I don't want to kill my soulmate. I don't want to murder my best friend. So Of course, many people experience those feelings. And so they are equating in their minds the word and the act of euthanasia as murder. And that, I think, is a barrier for people viewing it as, you know, a positive option or a loving, compassionate option. I don't know if that has to do with the language. I think that has to do with how people feel about the discomfort of making this massive life and death decision, which is extremely difficult and frankly something we don't have to do very often. So we don't have a lot of confidence in our ability to do it. So I think around language, you know, if your critical voice is telling you you're murdering or you're killing, and the equivalent to you is euthanasia, I think your language and words are going to get weird in your head.
As a pet loss grief therapist, counselor?
Counselor. I'm not a therapist. I'm a certified grief counselor, yeah.
Who also spends time as a pet chaplain. Mm-hmm. Are there cultural or religious considerations that influence the language that you're aware of?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think beyond religion too, a spiritual, you know, sort of beliefs. You and I have had discussions about the Rainbow Bridge. You know, there are many people who feel comfortable when talking about the death saying, you know, my cat went to the Rainbow Bridge, or my cat crossed the Rainbow Bridge, or journeyed to the Rainbow Bridge. That's a very comfortable euphemism for people, right? So that is not necessarily religious, but that's kind of a spiritual belief. There are many people, of course, who feel comfortable with, you know, my beloved, you know, walked into the eternal trail, or, you know, went to sail the eternal seas. I've heard language like that before. Or many people, of course, my beloved became an angel, or my beloved joined God. Some people say God took him, or God chose him, right? Or something like that. So I think, yes, where we are coming from sort of a spiritual perspective, you know, informs how we think about it, how we talk about it. I sort of like terminology just personal to me. I mean, I like the word transition because I do believe that death is a transition. And of course, we don't know. Nobody knows for sure what happens. But I know that, you know, when we have this transition, we leave our earthly body, or we leave our physical form. So I think about those kind of words a lot when I think about, you know, when Arnie died, he sort of left his earthly body. You know, he no longer was in that body. He transitioned, but I don't have exact language about where exactly he is. But I think about it very much in sort of an physical presence, earthside presence. That is the thing that happens in the transition. So those are words I use.
Do your clients frequently struggle with conceptions around euthanasia and death based on a lot of the words that we use?
Well, I don't, in the decision-making process, I don't know so much, but I think afterward, you know, a huge fear that many people have is, what do I say? Like, what do I tell people about what happened? I'm afraid to tell people that my beloved has died. I mean, died is a word that most people don't like to use. They don't want to use it. And a lot, you know, and I actually, I get heat on some of my Instagram videos because I use the words dead or death. And a lot of people say to me, why do you use the words dead when you talk about you have this ongoing relationship with Arnie, and your relationship with Arnie continues, and you believe that, you know, we are in a continued relationship with our beloveds, which I do believe that. But dead and death is a physical thing that is a word that I feel comfortable using. I am comfortable saying Arnie died. He died and left his earthly body. But many people are so afraid of the word died or dead. It's very scary to them. So a lot of my clients, I script people. I help people write scripts. Here's what I'm going to say about this, this, and this. And that extends to social media. People are very afraid to write a tribute. What do I say? Do I say, you know, Zelda died? Do I say Zelda transitioned? But if I say transition, people might not know what that means. And so then when they really understand that she's dead, you know, I mean, it's really, this is, yeah. So I think the anxiety I experience with clients is about, what do I say after the fact? How do I announce it? What do I write on the Christmas card? Mm. Do I write, you know, She died this year. I mean, I'm not comfortable with that. I don't like that word, a lot of that kind of thing. I think there's a lot of tension, not just when it happens, but kind of forever about what do we say, how do we talk about it. A lot of my clients won't use the word died or dead. They say things like, she had her sunset, right? That's like a way to think about it. Or some of my clients say she left, when she left. But then other people, they don't like that because, like, well, she didn't leave. She's with me always, right? So lots of tension around, I think, how we talk about it after the fact and anxiety.
For me, as a newspaper writer, it's died. And now as an editor, we have the young kids coming in and they will write passed away because they have to soften it for whatever reason. No, we're not in marketing and communications here, child. It's died. They died. It's a shorter way of saying it. We look at an economy of words in newspaperism. So I've never been afraid of the word died. And passed away just feels so. I mean, people aren't going to see my body motions right now, but it's like it's just such a flaccid way of saying something. So it doesn't mean anything to me, but that's me and my experiences, right?
Yeah. And again, I think that's probably an older term. If you want to talk about like the old school terms, I think passed away is something like my grandparents said a lot about people. Nobody I was growing up was saying they crossed over. I didn't hear any language like that, right? So
So how do you navigate the discussions around euthanasia with your clients who are in anticipatory grief or the after grief around if they're struggling with the language?
I have to say, a lot of struggles people have with language are things they are coming to me with that other people have said. So now we did an entire episode on this. You and I did about the types of things that people sometimes say that are boneheaded and misguided. So please go listen to that episode if you want to hear us rant on that, because we totally get down on that. But I, in some ways, I think this sort of tension that we're discussing here has a lot to do also with the way people talk to us about death in general. And so a lot of the things that people come to me with, when I'm seeing them week to week, I'm, hey, how you doing? How's it going? They're telling me things that people have said that made them very uncomfortable, or that really, an example, not totally specific to euthanasia, but about grief is like, have you moved on yet? Right? Or you need to move on. Or even you need to move forward. That can create a lot of tension for people, because if I'm moving forward, does that mean that, my grief and the loss of my beloved is in the past? Is that like, so is that backward? And so that, like, anything with moving in front of it can be very fraught. So, in that case, we talk about, okay, well, what feels right to you? And if you want to correct that, if you want to gently say, hey, like, here's how I think about it. Like a lot of the people I work with, we talk about like a moving with. I'm moving with my grief, I'm moving with my beloved, and we are moving. And personally, I enjoy the phrase moving through, but a lot of people don't like that with grief, right? Because that implies there's something to move through to get to somewhere else, right? So moving with can be a way, like, just on that note, if someone says, I'm moving on or moving forward, I'm moving with it. I teach a lot of my clients to sort of respond with language that feels authentic and comfortable for them, so that we can kind of subtly teach people the way we want to be spoken to. Now, sometimes you have to be a lot more direct, but I really like, empowering my clients to speak about it the way they want to speak about it. Same things go with past tense, present tense. A lot of my clients really struggle. Do I talk about my beloved in past tense or present tense? And, with all of this stuff, Angela, this is deeply personal. So I always say to people, we have to do what works for us. We have to do what feels authentic to us. And for many of the clients I work with, it's much more comfortable for them to speak in present tense. A lot of my clients joke about using the royal we. You know, weird Arnie and I are doing this. Arnie and I are hosting a memorial service on Instagram. I think all the time that Arnie and I are in collaboration doing things. And I teach my clients, I want them to feel in collaboration with their beloveds all the time. That's one way we can continue our relationship, live in their legacy, and feel connected. So, you know, that's a great model, but it gets tricky when we're then talking about them in past tense as if there's something that doesn't exist anymore. So lots of tension, you know, do I speak in present or past? And I always say to people, whatever feels right. And if you slip into past tense for sometimes and you're in present tense other times, that's okay too. Because the number one thing about anything in grief, especially language, is to not get too rigid with ourselves. And you know what? What feels good over time might change. You know, like language around how do we celebrate like the death anniversary date? That's a huge topic for my folks, right? So much tension around that. Is it even a day to celebrate? That's one question. But another question is, well, what do I call it? And I spend time with people like, you know, how do I think about this day? How do I talk about it? And it's different for everybody. Some people love the phrase angelversary, right? Some people like it as a remembrance day. Some people like it as an acknowledgement day. Some people like the kind of word anniversary. But for other people, that feels too celebratory, right? So, you know, I think this language tension isn't just about the immediate moment. It's like the rest of your life grief. How am I talking about it? How am I presenting it? How am I being judged for it? And how do I find my own lexicon to speak it?
There's also a level of showing ourselves compassion and being kind to ourselves with our words as well, isn't there?
Well, yes. 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 Like, what are some of your red flag words when you know you're not talking kindly to yourself? You must have some.
Oh, I call myself an asshole all the time. You know, if I'm direct and honest with other people, I got to be direct and honest with myself. So I'm an asshole.
That's pretty mean. Mm-hmm. Well, certainly. I mean, a huge focus of my work is working with guilt, right? Because pretty much that's a lot. I've never worked with a client who didn't have some level of shame, guilt, or regret about things in their animal's life or things in their
Of course, life, right? I said for years I killed my best friend.
That's right. Well, and that's not that's a very a kind or compassionate way to talk to yourself, right? And absolutely. So, you know, guilt is one of the top two things people come to me for, right? And I have I'm a guilt master. I got a ton of tools. I got all kinds of ways we can dial guilt down and help people really release a lot of that and get it in a right-sized kind of space. And in order to do that, part of the work has to be about becoming more self-compassionate with yourself, dialing down your inner critic, and really starting to understand that this sort of like modality you've been in for a lot of years, kind of beating yourself up and keeping yourself, quote, accountable to, quote, high standards, is actually just a cruel way to kick yourself down the stairs. And I have words that I don't like my clients to use, and I tell them what they are. And sometimes if they use them in session, I hold up my arms in this big X and I'm like, nope. It's a reminder to not say those words. So absolutely, I believe there is language and there are words we need to catch and not say things to ourselves. My least favorite word during grief is should. When people start shoulding all over themselves, this is not a kind, compassionate moment. I should be doing this. I should have done that. I should, if I really cared about my beloved, I should. Anything that comes after should, I really, if my clients use the word should in a session after a certain point, after I've taught them, you know, I'm like, we do a big X and a sound effect. I teach them replacement words for should. So one of my favorite replacements is I aspire to instead of I need to, or I have to, or I should, or I must, or I ought to. Doesn't that sound like your mother? You ought to do this. Maybe not your mother, my mother. You know, so it's like, what does it feel like to say, I aspire to spend more time working on my scrapbook project as opposed to I should be working on my scrapbook project? Feels completely, completely different. You know, it would make my life easier if I took a walk each day because I know I'd feel a little better getting my exercise in instead of I have to exercise every day. You know, when we should and have to and must and ought to, it really sets ourselves up for a lot of negativity. So that's a big set of words that I like to replace. Another word I don't really like to allow in sessions is overreact. I think I'm overreacting. A big one. Big word I like to replace, you know? And, you know, we're allowed to have strong reactions. We are grieving. We are having huge responses and reactions and emotional roller coasters every single day. And so whenever someone comes in, I just am worried I'm overreacting. We got to set that word straight because these are stories that we tell ourselves and these are old scripts that we are reinforcing. And if there's any opportunity in grief, and I believe there are opportunities in grief, I think a huge opportunity is we get to really start changing the way we treat ourselves about all of it. And one of the ways we begin to change the way we treat ourselves is how we talk to ourselves and how we treat ourselves and how we connect with ourselves through speaking. And I teach a lot of my clients how to speak to themselves out loud so that we can retrain what the brain wants to do. Because otherwise your brain's going to keep going down those muddy old tracks it's been going down for all these years. All of our harsh criticism of ourselves, that started so before our beloveds got into the picture. It's an old script. And so we got to start retraining ourselves to speak differently. And one of the best ways to do that is by talking out loud and saying the thing you want to say so that your brain actually hears it
Oh,
instead of just
cool.
thinking it.
Okay, so I'm Kaylee, and I have been engulfed in anticipatory grief, and I have been working with Beth Bigler through my anticipatory grief and learning how to be kind and compassionate to myself and say things that are loving for me. And then I go to the vet and I don't encounter the kind of language that Beth Bigler has helped me start to use to be more kind and compassionate to myself. What happens then?
Well, what'd the vet say? That mean
Yeah,
old
well,
vet. What'd the vet say?
well, it's been a while for me, but you know, it's time to put your dog down. It's time to put your dog to sleep. You have to euthanize your dog. And you know, are those not phrases that, I mean, we've already established that they can be triggering or activating. So how do we manage ourselves in that moment when the person we trust to know when our dog's life must end?
Well, yeah, anytime we're working with an animal care provider who has a different sort of alignment with us about how they're going to speak to us, regardless of what it is. I mean, I don't hear that feedback a lot of veterinarians saying things like that, which is a good thing, right? Like I'm hoping that isn't happening very often in that way. But I mean, geez, I'm sorry. I'm thinking about one of my experiences, you know, with Arnie's death. That was very painful. A vet tech said something just really rough, after Arnie died. That, you know, and that was before I was a vet loss grief counselor, before I knew about all this. And even though now I know, and oh my gosh, I have so much empathy for any veterinary care professional. They have tough jobs, but this person said something to me that should not have been said. It was so damaging. And like I had done a lot of anticipatory grief counseling. So I'm thinking about your scenario. I had a lot of tools in my toolbox that I wouldn't have had otherwise. But so I know what you mean. Like boneheaded, I won't even repeat it really because I can't repeat it because I think it would damage someone else. But I think like thinking back to that experience for myself, but of course I have a lot of clients who have you know, challenges with communication in this way. I think, you know, one of the things we can do if we're in a situation where we're hearing language that feels very, I'm going to use the word offensive. It was kind of a blanket statement. If something's offensive or doesn't resonate with you, I think the first thing to do is to, you know, kind of recognize within yourself, okay, I'm having a big reaction, right? Not an overreaction. I'm having a strong reaction to this word, and it's okay if I want to take a second or take a minute to sort of reframe it for myself, right? And think about what's being said to me, right? And you know, put my dog down. If a veterinary professional said, "You have to put your dog down," and I know that that means, you know, compassionate euthanasia, then maybe you like say to yourself, okay, he's trying to suggest that there's going to be, you know, euthanasia, it's time for euthanasia or something. I mean, you can kind of re-talk it to yourself. However, like, I also think we have a lot of options now, if we have time, about how we create the death for our beloved, and what is important to you, and what language do you want to use around it, and kind of who do you want to be working with. And so, like, I'm a big advocate of working specifically with hospice vets, who tend to have like a lot of specialty in kind of how to talk to kind of grieving and anticipatory people who might be a little more sensitive around these issues. Or if you're working with an in-home euthanasia company and you're talking to them and you're deciding if you want them to come, you can express your preferences about how you would like things said, right? Fascinating. I don't want to get it wrong. There was a documentary made about Lap of Love, and I'm a Lap of Love fan. I have used Lap of Love personally. And there was a documentary that I think they made, or someone made, about them and what they do. And they talk in there about the language they use, and how they have their veterinarians say different things to indicate that the animal has died. And they don't use the word die. They say different things, you know. And even when I was having my own Lap of Love experience last May, I was curious what the doctor was going to say, you know, for that moment. Because I was like, what's he going to say? You know, and it was fine. You know, it was not offensive to me. But I think, you know, all of this, whenever we receive something like that from a professional, a provider of any kind, when we receive something that doesn't resonate with us, we hopefully, if we've done our own homework and checked in with, okay, what are some words I don't like? What are some words I like? What was I taught? What do I want to unlearn? What do I want to teach myself? If we have sort of developed our own vocabulary around it, if you've been working with me and someone says something like that, you would take a minute, you'd allow yourself the big reaction that you're having, and then you would decide how you would respond. A big thing I work on with people, especially in anticipatory, is reaction versus response. And it's okay to have any kind of reaction we want, whatever it is, but we don't always have to make a response with the same feelings that come up in that reaction. So I would probably, if they had been working with me, they'd probably have a big reaction. And they'd think, how do I want to respond to this? And that may look like, hey, going forward, I would like you to use this language instead of the language you just used. Or it might look like, I'm not going to say anything because it doesn't really matter. Like, say whatever you want to say. I know my system and values and how I'm thinking about this. You know, I mean, you get to decide what you want to do with it. But, you know, I certainly, if someone had been working with me in anticipatory, I wouldn't expect that kind of misalignment in conversation to put any of my people off their game.
What I'm hearing there is similar to an episode I did with a gal named Cheryl Green around setting appropriate boundaries, including for the language that we use or would like others to use for us.
1,000%. Yeah. And that's tricky. And it's very tricky, you know, people, especially in medical settings, they feel like they can't assert themselves or that they know less, or a lot of people feel like they fall into kind of a submissive position in, in veterinary settings. That's a thing a lot of us get trained to do. That's something I work extensively with people on, how to talk to and communicate with their care providers. And you know what I tell a lot of people, if you are not comfortable setting boundaries verbally, you can always set boundaries in writing, and you can write down your list of, hey, here's how I would like to, you know, interact and talk about this. And you can hand it to them before your appointment, or you can email it to them, so that, you know, you don't, if you're very uncomfortable setting boundaries, and we don't have enough time in our grief counseling to like get your boundaries in order, that's another way to do it. In fact, in my own experience, I've had a ton of medical trauma. I have severe medical trauma from severe medical things that have happened in my life. And I actually have something written up for a very specific situation I get into with doctors, and I hand it to them if I'm seeing a new provider about a certain kind of thing. And I say, when you do this, it's for my eyes. When you do my eye exam, here are like three things that I need from you to feel safe and comfortable and to be your best patient. And please don't do these three things, because that will make me very anxious. And I already have a lot of anxiety around this. Right? So I have a list written up for that situation. And that's the kind of thing I have my clients do. Because when we get into a situation, it might be hard to verbally assert a boundary, but if we make a game plan ahead of time of like, here's like how I want to talk about this, and here's how I want to, and I say, you know, I teach my clients to say, you know, may I follow up with you via email if I have any questions, or if I have any, and you know, Every veterinarian says yes to that. Veterinarians really, they welcome getting follow-up because they want to make sure that your concerns are being addressed. And for many people, even setting boundaries in person can be really tricky. So I like to practice that verbally with people. But for a lot of people I work with, it's very hard in an emotional moment. So I'm a big fan of writing them down and either giving them at the appointment or having a permanent note in your file about it, or emailing in advance, or all three.
Throughout time, language has evolved in so many ways, mm-hmm. and we can be resistant to change in a lot of ways. I won't bring up any specific circumstances or anything, but as we move, as there is this movement with people like you and me, who are advancing the idea of pet loss grief and the normalization of it, the validation of it. Is it not true that the language has no choice but to change, evolve?
Well, I believe it already is. I'm super proud of my work on that front. I have to say, like, I love, you know, I have done a lot, and I didn't invent anything, right? But I have popularized and I have been relentless about certain words that I think are very important. And I have seen just in my experience, the ripple effect of that. Like I am so pro using the word guardian instead of owner. And yeah. Now like that has become a thing. And I have worked very hard to that. We call people guardians instead of owners. And that is such a more comfortable word for those of us who don't view our pets as property, right? So right. Guardian, and like, that's a word that I think is so important that we say. I have popularized, I know the phrase like soulmate pet. I didn't invent that phrase, or soul dog. I mean, that was before me, but I talk about our animals being soulmates, my soulmate cat, Arnie, right? And even mm-hmm. that gives such permission and validation for people to say, you know what, I feel that way about my dog, but I was always kind of afraid to say it, right? So I think a lot of the things that we and you and I together and everyone who's with us on this mission is to just use words that we think are supportive. Now, is the phrase guardian supportive to everyone? No. Is the phrase soulmate supportive for everyone? No. But trying to bring in a broader range of ways to say things and things that might feel validating or supported. That's why I always call animals beloveds. You know, you all the time read any of my posts, like, you're beloved this, you're beloved that, because to me, that's a very appropriate word. It sounds better than pet to me. It sounds better than animal to me, right? So I think we all have the power to evolve the language. And I've said before, like, one of my biggest pet peeves is the idea of the phrase pet loss grief. Mm. I don't like this phrase, even though I have to use it all the time in my work.
Name.
The phrase
There's pet loss grief.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. I'll tell you, well, to me, what it is. If we use the word widow, we don't tack on grief, widow grief, or child loss. That person has experienced child loss or is experiencing child loss. They're not experiencing child loss grief. They're mm-hmm. experiencing the death of a child. So why do we have to always tack on grief to pet loss? When we say a person is experiencing pet loss grief, it's a thing. It's everywhere. You see it everywhere. It's like we have to qualify that with the death of an animal, there is grief. That's my pet peeve about it.
Okay. Interesting.
Not that I love the word loss, by the way. I also don't love the word loss, but that is in the lexicon about, you know, pet loss. And I don't know what the upgrade for that is. I'm still working on some upgrades to that, but pet loss is certainly the phrase. And there is a loss. I mean, I can appreciate the word from the standpoint of there is a loss, but of course, from my standpoint as someone who has a continuing connection with their beloved, I have lost Arnie's physical form. But I have not lost our relationship, and I have not lost our connection, and I have not lost our collaboration. And it's something that I continue to give to and receive from. And we are more evolved. We are more connected. We are more close today than we were when he died many years ago. So for me, the word loss is even a little tricky, but I can accept the word loss, but I hate tacking the grief on the end of it. What do you hate about the phrase pet loss grief? What does it do for you?
It sounds clinical to me. It sounds like it's something that should be in the DSM, you know, and I just, It's very much, oh, this got into my head as you were talking. It's very much the same as talking about end of life pet photography sessions. Ugh, do I hate that? I hate it. And because it just sounds so clinical and final, and yet what I'm trying to do at my end of life pet photography sessions is celebrate a life, is to create incredible memories that, as we've talked about before with the continuing bonds theory, will help bring us healing and comfort in the future in the absence of their physical being. So to say end of life pet photography just sounds so final and so clinical and so horrible. I hate it. But at the same time, I have to use it to convey what I do and to search engine optimize my website.
Yeah, and I would say for now, that's what you have to do. And we can dream of the time when maybe we have evolved it even more. We've come a long way. You know, we have come a long way on this. In fact, to that point, like when I was naming my private practice, right? A lot of quote experts told me, oh, you need to put pet loss in your practice name. You need to put pet loss in your Instagram name because if people type in pet loss, they need to be able to find you. So, a lot of people on Instagram want to put pet loss as like the first two words of their Instagram name because they want people to find them so they can make money off that, right? I get it. But I could not, in good conscience, put the words pet loss in my business name or in my Instagram handle because to me, this isn't about loss. This is about honoring. And that's why I'm called honoring our animals. And has it dinged me on Instagram? Definitely. Definitely fewer people find me because I don't have the word pet loss in my handle. And I'm 1,000% okay with that because it is not authentic to what this is about. The death, the loss is part of this experience, but the much longer experience and the experience that came before that last earthly day is about the honoring. Honoring of the relationship earthside, honoring of the relationship now, and continuing that connection. And so that's been a huge thing. And I've had people give me like negative feedback about that. Well, you'd be doing better if you had pet loss. And I'm like, go ahead. I'd rather not be doing better than being authentic to my language.
Yeah, absolutely. And as someone who wants to speak appropriately to someone who is enduring pet loss, not pet loss grief, but pet loss, we've talked about this in our first episode together. It's about mirroring the language, right?
Totally. What do you remember about that? Do you remember? I could tell you, but we do. We had a great
I
discussion
remember
about it.
it, of course. I talk about it a lot too now. And
Yeah.
it's about active listening to the person who is in grief and then reflecting back on them the words that they use to describe their grief.
1,000%. That's right. So if perfect, A plus. So if someone says like, I really miss my fur baby. She was my baby and I loved her so much and she was my little daughter, right? Then when you talk about that beloved, use the word baby, use the word daughter, use the word fur baby. Those are comfortable words for that person. But if someone does not describe their beloved to you as a fur baby, please don't say fur baby, right? Same thing, we talked about the afterlife. If someone's talking about, oh, I feel so good because, she's at the Rainbow Bridge now and I'll get to see her there someday, then feel free, if it's authentic to you, to mirror back something about the Rainbow Bridge. But if they don't bring up the Rainbow Bridge, they may not like the Rainbow Bridge. The Rainbow Bridge may make them uncomfortable. The Rainbow Bridge may make them feel scared. So, don't bring it up. So my number one advice is really mirroring and listening. And if you have a friend who makes a social media post, really read what they say, read how they talk about it, read how they reference their situation, their beloved, their grief, and try to use as many of those words as possible. Because, first of all, comforting a griever, there's not much you can do. There's frankly, not much you can say. The best thing you can do is listen and hold space and just reflect back. This is so hard. I'm here for you. You know, I hear how painful this is and I'm right here with you. I mean, that is the most kind of supportive type of thing you can say. But if you're going to go beyond that, please stick to mirroring. It's the number one thing we can do. It requires a little more effort on our part in our listening, but it will be so much more meaningful to them than for you to impose any of, you know, your sort of language around it. Because let's be honest, none of us have great language around any of this.
Language is a funny thing. There are many out there who take umbrage with the term fur baby or dog mom and pet parent. Who cares that they do? If that's what you want to call yourself, honey, you fill your boots. The words we use around our pets emphasize the profound emotional bonds we share and acknowledge the roles our companion animals play in our lives. And they validate the intensity of the grief we feel when their time with us is done. Language plays a crucial role in how we perceive loss and grief. And those of us who yearn to acknowledge and validate your grief for your best fur friend are forcing a shift toward a more empathetic and inclusive language, one that reflects that deep emotional connection. As we continue to evolve, as we look at our companion animals as more than mere possession, as we understand that they are sentient emotional beings like us, so too will our words and our language evolve to better help us communicate the significant loss we experience when our pets die. I'm Angela Schneider, owner of Big White Dog Photography in Spokane, Washington, and your host at One Last Network, signing off to go get some Bella snuggles. Listen to One Last Network on whichever podcast platform you prefer. We're on Spotify, Apple, and Amazon. Don't forget to hit follow or subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And if you have a friend who might be interested in our content, make sure you share us with them. Thanks for listening.